dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. From time to time on the program, we've used the metaphor of The Matrix, a science fiction film in which humans literally imagine they are living out full and varied lives when, in reality, they're anchored to an enormous machine that uses their life energy as a power source for their machine society. Due to momentary lapses in the veil of drug-induced illusion, the film's characters confront the extent to which they are not free. Tonight on the program, we're going to return to the metaphor of the Matrix and look behind some American illusions. The 9/11 attack has been compared with Pearl Harbor, and that comparison may be more apt than many think. In the first hour, an interview with the author of a book that documents that the so-called surprise attack was anything but. It was deliberately provoked in order to gain public support for war, and U.S. leaders deliberately sacrificed the lives of several thousand in order to fuel public outrage. In the second hour of the program, we'll take a look at the mechanics of elections and the means whereby those in power rig the outcome through perfectly legal methods. And then we'll take a look at the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which purports to help workers, but, many say, actually serves to limit the ability of workers to organize and challenge the wage system. Robert Stinnett is the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. He spoke with Mike McCormick in Seattle last May about how he came to uncover the information that forever altered the official history of the alleged sneak attack that brought the United States into World War II.
Shortly after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, many here in the U.S. drew parallels between the attacks of September 11th and those that had occurred 60 years earlier when the Japanese military attacked U.S. forces stationed at Pearl Harbor. In light of the continuing stream of evidence related to both incidents, perhaps those who cited similarities were correct. Up next, we have an interview with writer and World War II veteran Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Stinnett's 15 years of research, combined with documents received through numerous Freedom of Information requests, for the first time bring to light solid evidence that not only did President Franklin Delano Roosevelt have prior knowledge to the attacks on Pearl Harbor, but had in fact been a participant in constructing the very scenario that would be used to bring the United States into the Second World War. I spoke with Robert Stinnett by phone.
What motivated you to write your book, Day of Deceit?
I was in the Navy in World War II, and we were always told that our Japanese warships were sighted by our submarines. But in 1982, I read a book that changed all that, because a book called At Dawn We Slept mentioned a U.S. Navy monitor station in Pearl Harbor that was operating prior to Pearl Harbor, you know, December 7th. That immediately called my attention to the fact that, hey, we were listening into the Japanese naval frequencies prior to December 7th or Pearl Harbor. So I wanted to do a news story for my paper that was the Oakland Tribune. And so I went to my editor. He gave me permission to go to Pearl Harbor and check this station out. And the space was still there. And I met cryptographers who told me about the operation, you know, prior to December 7th. So I had the confirmation that we were monitoring Japanese warships prior to December 7th. And if that was true, then we certainly had to know about the Pearl Harbor attack and the warships coming to Pearl Harbor. So that started my quest. And then to get more information, I had to file a Freedom of Information request with the Navy to see the actual intercepts of these Japanese messages. By intercepts, I mean the Japanese would transmit the messages over the radio, then we would intercept them. By we, I mean these radio cryptographers. So I wanted to see these the actual messages. So I had to file Freedom of Information Act requests with them, with the Navy, and they were reluctant to disclose too much of that. But I did get a few of them. But I got the greatest bulk, it was in January 1995. That was almost 10 years after I had started the quest to, first of all, to see the station, talk with the cryptographers, and then get the messages.
So when you first started your adventure, did you expect to find what you ended up finding?
Well, I expected that I would get to see some of the messages. By the messages, I mean the intercepted Japanese naval messages. And I was looking forward to that, and I thought that that might make a good nonfiction book, because I could describe to readers what we were intercepting, what the Japanese were saying. But I really found a gold mine, and really I would say a smoking gun, when the Navy finally released these records to me in January 1995 in that National Archives. And in that I came across a secret memo that prepared by the Navy that called for provoking Japan to attacking us at Pearl Harbor. And that I realized was the Pearl Harbor smoking gun, if that was true. And so I spent the rest of 1995 checking the records, checking the Navy records that showed that President Roosevelt personally adopted this Navy memo that called for 8 provocations to be aimed at Japan. And these provocations started in the fall of 1940 and continued right up to the attack. And the president actually signed the orders for most of these provocations. And the whole idea of these provocations was to do away with American civilian interest in not going into Europe's war. They wanted nothing to do with Europe's war. This is what it was called in 1940 and 41. There was a huge isolation movement in this country, led by Charles Lindbergh, that wanted nothing to do with what they called Europe's war. So this was the plan that the Navy adopted. It was to sort of a backdoor approach to get us into the war with, really, Germany, which was an ally of Japan in 1940 and 41. Now, this is actually what happened. This provocation plan was adopted, and it worked. Japan immediately started preparing to attack us at Pearl Harbor, and the plan first leaked out in January 1941 to the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, who notified Washington that Japan was planning a carrier attack on Pearl Harbor. And this was dated in January 1941. Then our cryptographers discovered the Japanese carrier force in April 1941, and then they just followed it all the way through to the attack. So they knew that the U.S. Navy and the highest levels of the government knew that Japan's carrier force was headed towards Pearl Harbor, because Japan's admirals, for some reason, this could not keep quiet on the radio. They broke radio silence, and our radio direction finders and our cryptographers located them in the North Pacific and also in the Central Pacific. So we detected 2 forces coming towards Pearl Harbor, one in the North Pacific, that was the carrier force, and the other one was in the Central Pacific, and this was the 30 submarines headed towards Pearl Harbor. So this information went to President Roosevelt and the military there in Washington, but they cut off this information from the Hawaiian commanders so that they would not interfere with this Japanese overt act of war. This is what that message, or this memorandum, I should say, in 1940 called for, was to get Japan to commit an overt act of war. That was our strategy, both in 1940 and 41, and that's what happened. And They wanted a clean-cut, overt act of war to unite this country with this outrageous act at Pearl Harbor. And then it worked. As you all know, the attack took place December 7th, 1941, and the next day, December 8th, you know, millions of Americans flocked to the recruiting offices of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and joined the military. And then civilians went to work in the shipyards, turning out the war materials.
So prior to the publication of your book and you're discovering this document in your Freedom of Information Act packets, none of this information had been known publicly, correct?
That is right. The this provocation memo had been kept secret. It was locked in Navy vaults in Crane, Indiana, in a steel vault so that it would have maximum security.
So, and you discovered it in 1995, and then when was your book first published?
The book was published in December 1999.
So it's still pretty fresh insights and info into this whole picture of what really happened.
Well, that's right, Mike. And the I'm still getting more information, you know, about the breaking of the Japanese Navy Code. I want to emphasize to your listeners that I'm talking about the Navy Code. It was always admitted that we had broken the Japanese diplomatic codes, but the fact that we had broken the Japanese Navy Code was withheld from Congress and in the public until 1995, when I first started following this trail.
Tell us about the man who came up with the eight-point plan. That was McCollum, is that right?
Yes. The author of the eight-point provocation plan was Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum, and he was head of the Far East desk of Navy intelligence in Washington. He was had a powerful position. He was also the routing officer for President Roosevelt. By routing officer, I mean he sent all these secret messages directly to President Roosevelt from his command post in the Navy Department, and they were delivered to the White House, sometimes by Commander McCollum himself.
Okay, and what was his background?
He was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He was born in Japan to Baptist minister parents, so he spoke Japanese, knew their culture before he even knew, you know, American culture. So for the first, I think the first 8 years of his life, he was living in Japan, played with Japanese children, and, as I say, spoke the language and knew their culture. Then his family returned to the United States, and he joined, or he was appointed to the Naval Academy in Washington, graduated, and then was sent to the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo in 1923. That was his first Navy job, you might say. And he was assigned sort of a social position, and he taught the future emperor of Japan and the court to do the Charleston. He was very close to the Japanese crown.
So he had, sounds like he had excellent insight and perspective into Japanese culture.
That's right. And so he could understand the Japanese mind, how they would work, and how that you could use provocations to tick off the militarist of the Japanese nation. And that's what he did. That was the whole idea of the provocations, was to get the militarists of the nation, of the Japanese nation, to seize control of the civilian government. And that's what happened. And we could follow that, their actions, by intercepting the messages, both diplomatic and military.
Okay, so can you give us some details into what the eight-point plan was?
Yes. They were numbered A through H. And the first was to send a division of United States cruisers into Japanese territorial waters. And that was done. There were three voyages into the Japanese territorial waters in the Central Pacific. And then also one went into the Inland Sea, the Bungo Strait, which is the main entrance to Japan's Inland Sea, and that's where all the Japanese naval operations were practiced. Another one is to cut off all Japanese oil, their access to oil in the Southeast Asia, Borneo, and Vietnam, and Indonesia, which at that time was controlled by the Dutch and also the British. And the British and the Dutch also agreed to go along with this embargo. Another one was to keep the fleet stationed at Pearl Harbor as a lure to this Japanese attack. And that was done. Then also to send United States submarines into the Far East. And then the final one was on July 1941, just about 6 months before Pearl Harbor, and the president signed an executive order. President Roosevelt signed it, and he ordered a complete embargo against Japan, cutting them off from oil. Their bank accounts were frozen, and this is really what set Japan off on a point of no return. That's when they started all out for war. All of this information, this 8-point memorandum and plan, the overt act of war plan, were all withheld from Congress, both in the 1945 investigation and also again in 1995, just a few years ago, Congress reopened it. So all of this was withheld. So it's just unassailable. There's no question about it that we were monitoring the Japanese fleet. We had 22 monitor stations in the Pacific, including there in Seattle was the headquarters for the West Coast Communications Intelligence of the Navy. It was headquarters on Bainbridge Island there in across Seattle at Elliott Bay. And so this headquarters had stations at Dutch Harbor, Alaska, all the way down to Imperial Beach in near San Diego. And these stations were getting radio direction finder bearings when the Japanese warships broke radio silence. You see that if you break radio silence, then you can locate the ship by these radio direction finders. And one of these was at Dutch Harbor, Alaska.
Some people state that perhaps Roosevelt didn't actually receive any of these documents, that this might have all been done by, let's say, hierarchy in the military. But you actually believe that Roosevelt had to have known.
Well, the president was getting these messages direct from Commander McCollum, who was his routing officer. And on November 27th, President Roosevelt issued the order to the Pacific commanders, both in Hawaii and in the Philippines, and told them to stand aside, don't go on an offensive, remain in a defensive mode, because the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act. Those are the exact words of the president. We've got that order, is published in my book, and that was the controlling plan that was originated by Commander McCollum, the overt act of war plan.
I have to imagine that it had to be pretty frustrating to a lot of the commanders at the different military installations.
Well, of course, the two commanders in Hawaii, that was Admiral Kimmel for the Navy and General Short for the Army, were not told about this. So they didn't know about it, but the major commanders in Washington did know about it. But they felt that this was the only thing to do. The American public had to be aroused to get in the back door to Hitler, who had, at the time, you see, had conquered all of Europe, was bombing London and planning to invade England, then seize the British fleet, come over here to North America, perhaps control Canada and take islands off of the east coast of the United States, you know, like Bermuda. That would have been a terrible peril for our country. And so this is what our military were really worried about, and that's why they went for this overt act of war plan, because Americans just didn't seem to care about getting into Europe's war. Just about a month before Pearl Harbor, German submarines sank U.S. warships there in the North Atlantic, including the USS Reuben James, which was on patrol, and we lost 100 sailors in that torpedoing. But no one gave a hoot about the sailors on the Reuben James. But when Pearl Harbor happened, that is what aroused the country. It was seen as a treacherous act by the American people, and that's what really got us into World War II.
Paint us a picture of what the situation at Pearl Harbor looked like prior to the Japanese attack there. You had a relatively new commander in charge of the Navy for that region, is that right, Admiral Kimmel?
Yes, very good question. President Roosevelt revealed this overt act of war plan to the fleet commander on October 8th, 1940. You see, this is a year before Pearl Harbor. He told the admiral that he wanted his ships and his sailors to stay in Pearl Harbor as a lure to a Japanese attack. Well, the admiral just blew up at the president right in the Oval Office. And he said, Mr. President, the Navy has no confidence in your leadership coming up with a plan like this. And so you don't talk to the president of the United States. An admiral doesn't do that. And the admiral was fired by the president. And then Admiral Kimmel took over in February 1941. So he is the one that took the hit for Pearl Harbor, and also his counterpart in the Army, General Short. Both of them were cut off from the flow of information from our intelligence sources.
What was Admiral Kimmel's background prior to being stationed at Pearl Harbor?
He was the number three commander of the Pacific Fleet just before he took over. He was commander of the heavy cruisers in the Pacific Fleet. So he was a graduate of Annapolis and had long experience in Navy operations that dated back to just before World War One. But he didn't seem to have the savvy that the Philippine commanders had, and didn't seem to see that he was being set up for this attack. Now, General Douglas MacArthur, which I'm sure most of your listeners know, he was head of the Army in the Philippines, and he was more prepared to go along with this overt act of war. And he replied to President Roosevelt's order to stand aside, and he said, in effect, yes, we're in a defensive mode. And MacArthur kept all of his aircraft on the ground, and they were destroyed by the Japanese. But you see, he was following the orders of the president. Don't interfere with the Japanese overt act of war. Let them come forward. And also the Philippine naval commander, Admiral Hart, he ordered all of his submarines to submerge in Manila Bay and not go after the Japanese invasion forces that were bearing down on the Philippines and also the Southeast Asia.
So was that at the point of time, just sticking with MacArthur for a minute, when he left that region and did his famous saying that I shall return?
That's right. MacArthur, as soon as he knew that the Japanese were going to land, he started preparing an escape route in the southern Philippines, and he had emergency runways made for B-17s, bombers that could come there and pick him up and his staff, including his wife and son, and fly him out. And that's what happened. I believe that was in about March 1942, when the Japanese were overrunning the Philippines, Bataan and Corregidor, which was MacArthur's headquarters. And as soon as he saw that he had to leave, he bailed out, taking a PT boat to the southern Philippines, and then got on the B-17s, went to Australia, then and saying, I shall return.
It kind of deflates some of the heroic stature of him by knowing that now, at least for that period of time.
Well, General MacArthur was a huge hero to the American people. He got the Congressional Medal of Honor for this escape from the Philippines and saying, I shall return. That was the kind of public relations that was needed, and General MacArthur had been former public relations chief of the Army when he was in Washington, D.C., so he knew the right things to say that would make him a leader in the eyes of the American public. And Admiral Kimmel didn't have that. He was not PR conscious. He didn't know how to spin the way that General MacArthur did, and General MacArthur was a great spinmeister all of his professional career.
So did Admiral Kimmel, did he have... It doesn't sound like he had access to the same information that MacArthur did. Is that correct?
That's right. Even though there was this monitor station that was part of his command, but the commander of that monitor station did not furnish Admiral Kimmel all of the information that he should have gotten. And then the cryptographer, it was named Joseph Rochford. He's really the founder of the U.S. Navy's cryptographic section and had the wherewithal to give this information to Admiral Kimmel, but did not. And after the war, he said that this overt act of war was a cheap price to pay to unify the country. By the cheap price, he meant the loss of about 2,500 sailors, Marines, and Army troops there at Pearl Harbor on December 7th.
All right, how about General Short? He was obviously cut off from a lot of information as well.
That's right, and he had his own monitor station, just like General MacArthur had his monitor station there in Manila. But the Honolulu station that was supposed to serve General Short, he was cut off. He was not told by his own men that they were intercepting these crucial messages, even though this interception was going on probably a couple of blocks away from the general's headquarters. And the general never realized what was happening. And he died of heart trouble about 1947. So he really didn't learn what was really going on in his lifetime. But Admiral Kimball, he lived to about 1964. So he eventually learned that he was a scapegoat. And his family have been trying ever since to get him cleared and restored to his original rank. And Congress, to their credit, in October 2000, both the House and the Senate voted to restore Admiral Kimball and General Short to their original ranks, and they made the finding that this information, this crucial intelligence information, was withheld from them. It was up to the President Clinton, or now President Bush, to actually sign the orders to restore their ranks. And Clinton didn't do it, and neither has President Bush.
Was your book out at that time where Clinton would have access to the new information you've brought forward?
Yes, that was all available. See, this was in October 2000, and my book was published in December 1999. So President Clinton had that information, and Congress did too. And the Kimmel family says, and so does the Short family, says that my book and the revelation of the book helped to convince Congress that this vital information was withheld from the Hawaiian commanders.
You actually were in the Navy during World War II, is that correct?
Yes, I served in the Navy in photo intelligence aboard an aircraft carrier, the USS San Jacinto, in the Pacific. So I was very familiar with carrier operations because we were photographing it all the time.
So just from people that might want to paint you as somehow being, let's say, unpatriotic for bringing forth these ideas about Pearl Harbor, it sounds like you have a significant investment in the Navy and what actually happened in World War II.
Yes, I spent 4 years in the Navy. I have 10 battle stars in these major battles that we fought there in the Pacific against Japan. And the people can make the argument that, exposing this overt act of war could be unpatriotic, but you can also argue that this took a strong commander like President Roosevelt to issue these orders, knowing that you're going to put American lives at stake. But he had no other choice. You can argue that Hitler had conquered all of Europe and was going to invade England, come over here. That was a huge threat to our country. Provoking an enemy isn't new for the United States. It happened in the Mexican War with President Polk, I think it was in 1846, where he provoked Mexican troops to attack the U.S. Army along the Rio Grande. President Lincoln did it at Fort Sumter. The USS Maine in the Spanish-American War, the Maine was blown up in Cuba, and that caused the Spanish-American War. And then most recently, the Gulf of Tonkin, where the alleged North Vietnamese gunboats attacked the U.S. warships there. And that was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that really caused us to get into the Vietnam War.
I want to go back to some of the supporting evidence, that some of which has been out, but a lot of which you dug up, that President Roosevelt and his staff must have known about this ahead of time. One of the items, I believe, was that the FBI was tracking a spy on Oahu in Pearl Harbor itself.
Oh, yes, right. The Admiral Yamamoto, who was head of the Japanese Navy, sent a Japanese naval officer who was a graduate of the Naval Academy, and he was sent to Pearl Harbor under a nom de plume, a false name, and he was a Japanese naval officer, an ensign, but he was posted to the Japanese consulate in Honolulu as a chancellor of the consulate, in the diplomatic post. when the Japan applied for his, they call it a protocol, when you are admitted to the country as a diplomat, the FBI checked in the Japanese Foreign Ministry, and this spy, who's in his nom de plume, was not listed in the ministry register. So that alerted the FBI and also Naval Intelligence immediately that this guy was suspicious. Not only that, he was 28 years old, very young, and Honolulu in Hawaii was a sort of a retirement for the Japanese Foreign Ministry, and they usually assigned only people like in their late 40s, early 50s, a sort of a retirement post. So here's this very young person without any record at all assigned to the consulate in Honolulu. So they immediately were suspicious, and then they started intercepting messages that he started sending to the Japanese Navy. First of all, providing a census of the United States fleet there in Pearl Harbor, how many battleships were there, carriers, where the guns were located, and that sort of thing. And then in August 1941, he changed from a census reporting to preparing bomb plots of Pearl Harbor. By bomb plots, I mean actual maps, where he located where the warships were anchored or docked at Pearl Harbor, where the battleships were, carriers and so forth. And this continued. Well, all of these intercepts, which the spy was sending from Honolulu to Tokyo, were intercepted by our these stations, including the one there in Seattle. And these were sent to Washington, where they were shown to President Roosevelt. So we knew that the spy was dividing Pearl Harbor into grids where they could direct the aircraft to bomb. No grid, say, A1, A2, that sort of thing. And then the spy, in the last week before the attack, starting on December 2nd, he sent messages saying, they're not wise to what we're up to, and there are no barrage balloons up, and it's all clear for a surprise attack on these places. This is what they actually said, and they were intercepted before the attack. But, you see, nothing was done because the orders were from the president and our military, let Japan commit the first overt act of war. And even on the morning of December 7th, our radar operators located the Japanese aircraft once they took off from the carriers and were proceeding to Pearl Harbor. These were picked up. The radar operators got excited. They realized that this was a huge force of aircraft, and they tried to get through to General Short, but they could not do it. And I'm sure that it was not related to General Short because they were following this overt act of war policy. Let Japan commit the first overt act.
Now, at some point after Admiral Kimmel took over at Pearl Harbor, didn't he try to do some type of reasonable defense, kind of overriding what he was being told to protect Pearl Harbor?
Yes, that is right. He kept asking for more anti-aircraft guns, for more aircraft carriers, more warships. But the administration, the Navy Department, took away some of his carriers and other warships and moved them to the Atlantic. So by the time of Pearl Harbor, there were just three aircraft carriers, United States aircraft carriers, in the Pacific. One of them was at San Diego, and there were two at Pearl Harbor. But those two carriers and all of their supporting warships were moved out of the harbor about 5 days before Pearl Harbor, before December 7th. So what was left there were the old warships of World War I, including the 9 battleships that really took the hit, and some of them were sunk, including the USS Arizona. But these were old battleships that were built in 1912, and could not keep up with the carriers. They were too slow. So all of the modern ships were out of Pearl Harbor, so they would not be harmed by the attack. And Japan made a tactical mistake by bombing these ships. They should have bombed the fuel supply at Pearl Harbor and the electrical grid that controlled all the power. But they didn't do that. They made a mistake.
It does seem curious that Japan missed the oil depots that were on the island there, since oil was such a key issue. I mean, it was one of the 8 points in the original plan to force them to attack us.
Yes. Well, I think the Japanese admirals made the same mistake as that maybe the American admirals, that they thought that the battleships were the big stars. They were the might of the fleet, and so that's what they were after, was the battleships. I guess that would make bigger headlines than hitting the oil reserves. But really, it was the oil reserves that powered the fleet, and without them, you had to bring all the fleet back to the West Coast. And also the machine shops, the dry docks that there were at Pearl Harbor that could repair the ships, they just overlooked those. They were after the battleships, because that's what, you know, the motion pictures of the 1930s always showed the battleships with the movie stars like Dick Powell and Ruby Keeler dancing all over the decks. This is what people thrilled at, were the battleships. And that was the focus instead of the carriers.
Wasn't there at some point where, I believe it was Admiral Kimmel, actually took the fleet there at Pearl Harbor out searching for the Japanese fleet?
Oh, yes, Mike. Thank you. Yeah. 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor, Admiral Kimmel recalled the Pacific Fleet warships that were on rest and recreation on the West Coast, and brought them to back to Pearl Harbor and sent them north of Oahu to the exact location where the Japanese carrier force was going to launch their planes. And this is an area just about 200 miles north of Oahu, over, it's called the Procopia Seamount. It's an underwater volcano. And Admiral Kimmel had the Pacific Fleet, about 200 ships, looking for a Japanese carrier force. And it was labeled an exercise. But it started on Sunday morning. Then suddenly, it was called off. The exercise was supposed to last until Tuesday, November 25th. But it was called off on Monday, November the 24th, when Washington learned that Admiral Kimmel had the fleet there north of Hawaii in the exact location where the Japanese were going to launch the aircraft. And I mean exact, it was exactly over the Procopia Seamount. And so Admiral Kimmel had no other choice. He recalled the fleet and sent them back to Pearl Harbor, where they anchored, and except for the carriers who were moved out, the battleship stayed in that position until they were attacked by Japan's bombers and torpedo planes.
So it sounds very much like, at least for Admiral Kimmel, that he tried very hard to try and protect Pearl Harbor, and he was totally cut off by Washington and the people supporting Washington.
That is right. And it seems to me that he had some kind of an inkling that Japan was up to something, because why else would he have ordered the Pacific Fleet of 200 warships up there in the exact location where Japan was going to launch just 2 weeks in advance on December 7th? But Admiral Kimmel died in 1964, and so we don't really know if he was given that information or he was just there on a hunch or what. But he labeled it an exercise, and it was entitled Looking for a Japanese Carrier Force.
Do you think that Admiral Kimmel and General Short, perhaps since they'd both had previous commands, that they had a sense that they weren't getting information, all the information that they normally would?
Well, yes, you're right there. In the spring of 1941, Admiral Kimmel, soon after he had taken command, sensed that he was not getting certain intelligence information. So he pleaded with the Chief of Naval Operations, that's the head of the U.S. Navy. He said, please send me all information. I'm the commander here. I need to have it that the department has, meaning the intercepts. Well, the Chief of Naval Operations said, we're going to send them to you. You're going to be getting them. But he didn't. He did not send it to him. Admiral Kimmel was totally cut off.
Talk to me a little bit about, as far as you know, the U.S. had broken. We had broken the diplomatic codes for quite a while. And how long had we known about the Navy codes? How long had those been broken?
The Japanese Navy code that was used in World War II, which was used to organize the Pearl Harbor attack, was first introduced in June 1939. And Japan changed the code about every 6 months. But we kept on top of it. We had a brilliant Navy cryptographer. The chief Navy cryptographer was Agnes Meyer Driscoll. And she was a real cipher brain. She was a graduate of Ohio State University in statistics and physics. She really understood how to break these codes, and so she did it. And Japan would change it about every 6 months, and they would call it, first it would be like edition one, edition two, and so forth. So in the fall of 1941, their Navy code was edition seven. But we broke that, and we were fully reading their messages by November 16th, 1941, where the one of the main monitor stations in the Philippines that served General MacArthur and Admiral Hart notified Washington that we are current in reading the Japanese naval code as of November 16th. That was Manila time. It's important to remember that date, Mike, because on that same day in Washington, D.C., it was November 15th because of the international dateline, General George Marshall, who was the head of the U.S. Army, called news media to his office in the War Department, pledged them to secrecy, and told them that meaning the United States, had broken the Japanese codes, and the Japanese did not know it. And he said, we're expecting trouble on the first week of December. These were the bureau chiefs of the Washington News Media, New York Times, Associated Press, United Press, New York Herald Tribune, and others. And they all agreed to the secrecy and did not reveal this. General MacArthur should have notified the Hawaiian commanders, but he didn't even send them a postcard. And no hint at all, because he wanted this overt act of war to unite the American public.
So major members of the media were complicit in this as well.
They went along, as they did in those days. They would call it background briefing. And they did send memos to their editors, like at Time Magazine. I have that in the book, where the editors of Time Magazine were told that we had broken the Japanese code, and General Marshall expected trouble the first week of December. President Roosevelt also notified his cabinet that he expected war to begin starting December the 1st. So there's more evidence that he also was in on all this.
And again, you have obviously evidence for all of this. Can you tell us about what some of that is? It's some of its Freedom of Information Acts.
Yes, all of this information is from filing the Freedom of Information Act with the Navy, who are releasing this information. And the Freedom of Information Act is a federal law. It's on the books. It has the full force of the federal government. If you deny this, you can go right to federal court. And if you prevail, then they have to turn it over to you, or they send the U.S. Marshals in to get the information.
And as well as some of this comes from people's diaries?
There are a few diaries, but most of this is the original intercept and the orders from the Navy files that were, secreted from public disclosure for close to 50 years. And these are the original records, and they're now in National Archives in College Park, Maryland. This is on the campus of the University of Maryland, and it's a beautiful facility, and you can, see these records now. You have to go into a secure room because you're handling the original records, and to realize that you're seeing the records that maybe no one has seen for 50 years is really, I would say it was exciting for me as a newsman and an author.
What's your sense? You're still seeking out a lot of documents on this. What's your sense of how much you've actually dug up so far? How much still remains?
Well, I have the all the major smoking guns. That's certainly that overt act of war memorandum of Commander McCollum's, the admission that we were breaking and we were reading the Japanese naval code as of November 16th. These are all smoking guns. And what I'll be finding now are more, say, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. We'll get more information on that. But, I don't know where else. You can be surprised and get even more smoking guns. I had no idea that memorandum was written by Commander McCollum even existed, because no one had ever heard about that before.
during your search for some of this back during the Clinton administration, you were refused a bunch of documents. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. In fact, when I first started, this would have been in when Ronald Reagan was president, then George Bush, then Clinton took over. I was having, it was like pulling teeth, you know, to get any information out of them at all. And even today, I was in National Archives in February of this year, and seven archival boxes of these intercepts and information have been withdrawn. I don't know why this is withdrawn, but it has to do with Pearl Harbor in some manner, because you can tell by the numbering of the boxes. So I'm in the process of going to the National Security Agency, who controls all this information, and asking that these be declassified so that the public and I can see this information.
It doesn't seem like there could be too many reasons at this point left in why they would want to keep those documents secret.
I agree with you, but I don't know what it is. It might have some. There might be some Russian intercepts in there, where they're intercepting the Russian government, you know, their navy or something that knew something about Pearl Harbor. That's the only thing that I can understand why they would have this secrecy still going on.
What's your sense of how many people knew prior to Pearl Harbor, and obviously for the last 50 years, how many people were in the know about keeping things secret from the commanders there at Pearl Harbor?
I list them in my book. I can document at least 35, maybe as many as 50 of the very highest of command knew about the Japanese warships coming to Pearl Harbor, as well as to Wake and Guam, and then also Japanese diplomatic strategy, too. We knew all of that. So these 35 to 50 were in the know, and certainly the cryptographers that were intercepting these messages certainly knew about it, especially the radio direction finder operators who could put a beam on these warships. They knew that they were getting closer and closer to Pearl Harbor, so it could be even more than 50.
As a newsman yourself, with many years' experience in the field, do you find it somewhat disturbing that many people could know about this, that this could go on for 50 years, that there could be congressional investigations into this, and that no one basically hear about it for that length of time?
Yes, well, I think that is just the thing that we have to worry about as a country. I certainly agree, and I think everyone would, that we had to keep this secret during the war, and maybe even for a few years after World War II, but certainly not after 1955, you know, after the Korean War. This all should have been released. But see, all of these officers that were part of this design acknowledged that this should be our strategy. They were still alive, and I think it was to protect their reputations that this was all probably withheld. And I think my theory there has a lot of weight, because the releases didn't come until really 1995, when all of these had died off, so their reputations would not be sullied.
You're still working on digging up more documents. Where do you go from here with this story?
Well, I'm working now on a new book that I'm following this Mrs. Driscoll that I talked to you about, who was the Navy's chief civilian cryptographer starting in World War One, and she was, you know, served, I think about 11 presidents, from Woodrow Wilson to Jimmy Carter or Lyndon Johnson. I've forgotten the exact date. But I want to go into her records there and find out how much she knew. She was the one that really broke the Japanese codes as well as the German codes. And I want to see how much she knew about Germany and the Holocaust, because she was breaking the German police codes, the Gestapo codes. And we had special radio operators there in Europe listening to the Nazis when they took over in 1933. So there's a whole pattern there that I want to check on.
And finally, how has the media received your book and your information?
The book has been reviewed worldwide, and I've got including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, San Francisco Chronicle, and I've been on radio talk shows coast to coast and border to border. We got about 70% approval rating, but there's about 30% of people that think that, oh, this is terrible to sully President Roosevelt's reputation. They just will not accept this latest information, this information of the 21st century. They're wedded back there to the 1950 record.
Well, Robert Stinnett, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Mike, and I'm glad to talk to your listeners there at the University of Washington.
You just heard an interview with writer and World War II veteran Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. To continue our discussion on the events surrounding Pearl Harbor, we are joined this morning by another World War II veteran, O'Kelly McCluskey. O'Kelly, thank you for joining us this morning.
Really glad to be here. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. And the nation owes a debt to Robert Stinnett for the book that he's written, Day of Deceit, and I urge everybody to go out and buy it immediately and become informed on this issue, especially in light of what's happening today.
Talk to me about how you got involved in this situation.
Well, immediately after 9/11, well, I should go back before the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, I attended the UW expose on what happened at Pearl Harbor and was totally dissatisfied. They continued to maintain that it was a surprise attack. And my question at that time was, how come the carriers were gone from Pearl Harbor? I knew that the Arizona was built in 1913 because my father, as a Marine officer in the 1930s, had served on it. So at 9/11, they kept saying, just like Pearl Harbor, just like Pearl Harbor. I hear them saying that today, that they should have a Pearl Harbor commission to investigate what's going on today. And I think that if they go back and find out that the Pearl Harbor Commission that we've had over the years until Robert Stinnett got into this, that we've just had one cover-up after another over the years.
And you are currently doing a campaign to bring out the missing information about Pearl Harbor. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I went out after the 9/11 event. I saw a program in which Robert Stinnett appeared, and it was on TV, put out by Grizzly Adams. And The Unexplained is the name of the series, and I just caught it on TV. And Robert Stinnett was on there with another author. His name is Mark Wiley, and he wrote the book Pearl Harbor, Mother of All Conspiracies. And so at that time, I was thinking, I hope I'm not alone here thinking that this is, if this is just like Pearl Harbor, there was no surprise. And so I went out and started asking WW2 vets, wherever I'd meet them, at Costco's or the 7-Eleven and something, and do you think that Roosevelt was surprised? The net of that effect of that poll that I conducted was I talked to 134 World War II vets, not one of them thought there was a surprise at Pearl Harbor. And so on that basis, I wrote to the president a petition, and the petition is in the name of the Arizona sailors entombed for 60 years, we, the survivors of WW2, respectfully demand that all the pre-Pearl Harbor attack facts be declassified. Only the truth will let their brave young spirits rest peacefully in their watery grave. And then I went on to state, between this past December 7, 2001, and the next December 7, 2002, another 365,000 of us will go to our graves. You dishonor us who serve by continuing to cover up the facts. In the spirit of Johnny McKeon, my cousin and friend, American Legion post in Dorchester, Massachusetts, now named after him, we call upon you to do the honorable thing. We grandfather vets want to tell our grandchildren the real facts. And so then I give an address where you can reach us, and we put out a petition, and the address is Green Crow, spelled with a K, and then my zip code number 98036, at hotmail.com. And I'll try to remember to repeat that again later for you. But if you go to the booksellers,
Amazon.com.
Amazon.com, and just check out both of these books. They'll give you all kinds of documentation. And one of the things that Stinnett talked about was the messages that were intercepted. And I'm going to read you one of the messages that was intercepted. On December 1st, when the Japanese fleet was out in the middle of the Pacific, coming across the North Pacific before they turned south, on December 1st, the tanker fleet sent a message to the carrier fleet saying, radioed, and this brings out Stinnett's point that there were, in fact, radio messages, radioed proceeding to a position 30 degrees north, 154 degrees, 20 minutes east. Expect to arrive at that point on December 3rd. And this proves that they didn't maintain radio silence. The fact that this message is in the National Archives destroys the myth that the attack fleet maintained radio silence. So, and in Stinnett's book, you can also get a map showing the plots from the radio directional finding stations, showing the Japanese fleet moving across the Pacific to the point where on December 3rd they refueled, then they turned south, and on the 6th they have a plot also just north of Oahu, so that's where they launched from. So we really need to inform ourselves, especially in light of the fact of what's happening today. Can our grandchildren trust what the president is now telling us? That's the issue. And the issue is, what did he find out and when did he find out?
You actually take issue as well with Stinnett's view that what FDR did was a show of strength, that he needed to do that to bring America into the war.
Well, I understand Stinnett's position because at my house, we had great admiration. My parents are Irish, Boston Irish stock, and both my parents voted for FDR, FDR, FDR. That's all we heard. But at the same time, my mother was a peace person from World War One. My father was a Marine officer in the 2nd Marine Fleet Reserves. He was a captain at that time, and I can remember him talking to my mother and the people next door and telling them that Roosevelt's not going to get us into a war. And he took me over to hear Roosevelt say that. I won't get, I hate war. If you ever heard Roosevelt, you never can forget it. I was just a young boy, probably 14. And so my dad took me home and said, tell your mother now what Roosevelt said. He promised not to get us into war. So you get the wrong impression when Stinnett says it was Lindbergh. Lindbergh is a symbol of the, I don't know. I can't get into that part of it. But if you read the book by The New Deal is War by Fleming, he covers this, and he says that in October of 1941, the polls showed that 80% of the American public were actually absolutely opposed to going to a war in Europe. I remember my father saying to my mother, and he can't get us into it. They can't even explain World War One yet. How is he going to get us into another war? And that was basically what happened. At the same time, the people that lived next door to us, my brother joined up on December 8th. The two boys, twin boys that lived next door to us, joined up that same day. And by August of 1942, they were both dead. The twins were both dead. Anyhow, I hope that you'll join with us in trying to get this petition signed to so we World War II vets can know before we go to our graves, and so that we can tell. I mean, this is a job of grandparents. The grandfathers are supposed to tell the young about their experiences, and that's our job. And so I've written to the president and to his father and said, how about signing our petition? You know, let's have the facts out. Are we going to take 60 years after this event now that's happening? Is it going to take 60 years and then we're going to be out pleading with them to release all the information? It's ludicrous.
So let's give out your contact information again.
Okay, it's Green Crow, spelled with a K, Green, K-R-O-W, 98036 at hotmail.com.
As well as it sounds like you would encourage people to contact all their representatives and
absolutely
get their support on this.
Absolutely. And anybody else that you can think of. And also, one of the things that I did on the polls, I asked the college students and high school students to ask their grandfathers what they thought. And, you know, most of the young people didn't felt like, well, I don't want to talk to my grandfather. I said, he wants to talk to you. And so I hope that you will do that and get back to us and let us know or contact the president and let him know. We released the information about Pearl Harbor to the World War II vets, the grandfather, so they can tell their grandchildren.
All right. Well, O'Kelly McCluskey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, Mike.
That was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle speaking with Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor.